Deuteronomy 15 continues with the Lord's laws concerning helping the poor and the disadvantaged. God's character is such that he places the needs of the poor as a high priority, but he also places the responsibility of caring for the poor on the shoulders of every individual in the community, of those who are set apart for God, with those having the most expected to do the most. And as we prepare to read chapter 15, take notice that the God principle of release or remission is front and center. More specifically, here in this chapter, it is release from debt and bondage. Now, we're going to examine this concept very carefully because release or remission is one of the principles upon which mankind's salvation rests. Release, shmitah in Hebrew, indicates a cancellation of indebtedness that often involves servitude in a very literal way in ancient times. And the New Testament emphasizes that by means of faith in Messiah, we gain release from our debt to God due to our sins against him, and from our servitude to sin itself. It is, of course, in the Torah where we find the principle of release that's thoroughly discussed. The New Testament fully expects the reader to already understand it. Now, please also be reminded of what Deuteronomy actually is. Deuteronomy is really Moses' Sermon on the Mount. It is Moses expounding upon the law. He's preaching, if you would. Therefore, Deuteronomy will take a stated principle or a law, a commandment, many of which we've encountered in earlier books of the Torah, and then go on to explain its meaning and intent and how the principle needs to be carried out. Sometimes things are modified slightly because the situation of living in tents out in the wilderness was significantly different than living a settled life in villages, in cities that they're going to live in Canaan. So let's read Deuteronomy chapter 15 all the way through it. Open your Bibles to Deuteronomy chapter 15. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 214. At the end of every 7 years, you are to have a Shemitah, a release. Here is how the Shemitah is to be done. Every creditor is to give up what he has loaned to his fellow member of the community. He's not to force his neighbor or relative to repay it, because Adonai's time of remission has been proclaimed. You may demand that a foreigner repay his debt, but you are to release your claim on whatever your brother owes you. In spite of this, there will be no one needy among you, because Adonai will certainly bless you in the land which Adonai your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess, if only you will listen carefully to what Adonai your God says and take care to obey all of these commandments I'm giving you today. Yes, Adonai your God will bless you as he promised you. You will lend money to many nations without having to borrow. You will rule over many nations without their ruling over you. If someone among you is needy, one of your brothers, in any of your towns in your land, which Adonai your God is giving you, you're not to harden your heart, you're not to shut your hand from giving to your needy brother. No, you must open your hand to him. Lend him enough to meet his need. Enable him to obtain what he wants. Guard yourself against allowing your heart to entertain the mean-spirited thought that because the seventh year, the year of Shemitah, is at hand, you'll be stingy towards your needy brother, not give him anything. For then he might cry out to Adonai against you, and it will be your sin. Rather, you must give to him, and you are not to be grudging when you give to him. If you do this, Adonai your God will bless you in all of your work and everything you undertake, for there will always be poor people in the land. That is why I'm giving you this order. You must open your hand to your poor and your needy brother in the land. If your kinsman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, he is to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year you are to set him free. Moreover, when you set him free, don't leave him empty-handed, but simply But supply him generously from your flock, threshing floor, wine press, from what Adonai your God has blessed you with, you are to give to him. Remember, you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and Adonai your God redeemed you. That is why I'm giving you this order today. But if he says to you, I don't want to leave you, because he loves you, he loves your household, because his life with you is a good one, then take an awl and pierce his ear through, right into the door, and he'll be your slave forever. Do the same with your female slave. Don't resent it when you set him free, since during his 6 years of service, he's been worth twice as much as a hired employee. Then Adonai your God will bless you in everything you do. All the firstborn males in your herd of cattle and in your flocks you are to set aside for Adonai your God. Do not do any work with a firstborn from your herd or shear a firstborn sheep. Each year you and your household are to eat it in the presence of Adonai your God in the place which Adonai will choose. But if it has a defect, it's lame or it's blind or has some kind of a fault, you're not to sacrifice it to Adonai your God. Rather, eat it on your own property. The unclean and the clean alike may eat it like the gazelle or the deer. Just don't eat its blood. Pour it out on the ground like water. Within the first 18 verses, we find a set of three provisions of the law that are designed to properly care for and protect the most vulnerable, the most dependent of Israeli society, the poor. And these laws deal with the things that vex the most needy of every society, their inability to obtain loans. And if they get a loan, how are they going to pay off that loan? And then how this can often end up as indentured servitude, which was often the only way a poor person had to pay back borrowed money or even to make a living. This is not the first time in the Torah that we've run across these provisions concerning servitude, debt, and then release. We find ordinances about this subject in Exodus chapters 21 through 23 and in Leviticus chapter 25. It would make today's study a bit too long to go back and examine and compare all those passages with these similar ones here in Deuteronomy. So let me just make some personal observations about them. First of all, the Exodus laws and the Deuteronomy laws are very similar to one another, but the laws of Leviticus on this subject are a bit different. The most outstanding differences involve who are subject to these laws, and in what situations the laws are to be applied. Second of all, Deuteronomy and Exodus are concerned with the welfare of individual persons, whereas Leviticus is more concerned about the corporate welfare of family units and maybe even the nation as a whole. Israel was a tribal society with its structure consisting of family units called households, clans, and tribes. A household was the smallest unit. It would equate to what we in modern Western society today would call an extended family. It usually consisted of three, maybe four generations of a single family living in a tightly knit economic and social relationship. The next level up from that was a clan that consisted of several branches of extended families that pointed to a common ancestor going back many generations. The level above the clan then was the tribe. It consisted of a group of clans that could point back to a single founder of the tribe. Households then had the closest blood relationships among the individuals, clans a little bit less than that, tribes the most distant. So while Leviticus is more concerned with the welfare and rights of entire clans and tribes, Deuteronomy and Exodus are more concerned with the individuals that form households. It's in Leviticus that we get the laws of Jubilee, that every 50 years Hebrew servants are to be completely released from service to their masters. Land that's been sold is to be returned, to be remitted to its original owner, and all monetary debts are canceled. Yet here in Deuteronomy, we find laws that cancel debts and release slaves from their servitude come in a far shorter cycle. Every seventh year instead of every 50th. The 50-year cycle of release is called the Jubilee cycle. The 7-year cycle of release is called the sabbatical year cycle. Now, I want to draw you a picture of what kind of impact these laws have. If you can imagine the scenario whereby you loan money to a poor person in need, but the law says that at a predetermined point in time, that entire loan must be forgiven and the debt canceled, regardless how much, if any, of that debt's been repaid. Then you can also imagine that as the lender, you'd certainly prefer that this forgiveness cycle occur once every 50 years and not every 7. On the other hand, if you're a borrower, you'd much prefer that your debts were forgiven every 7th year instead of every 50th. So as you can probably also imagine, the sages and the rabbis have had a field day since the Torah was written, trying to determine just how to reconcile the laws of release as stated in Deuteronomy and Exodus. They were based on a 7-year cycle versus the laws of Leviticus that was based on a 50-year cycle. And which law would prevail under what circumstance of indebtedness and servitude? Theologically speaking, the apparent discrepancy between the laws of release of Leviticus versus those of Deuteronomy and Exodus presents us with a challenge to try and reconcile them. The standard method to make all these laws come into harmony rather than conflicting with each other, on their face has generally been to say that the 7-year cycle of release, what's intended is not complete cancellation of the debt, but rather only that payments towards paying off the debt can't be collected during that 7th year of each 7-year cycle. In other words, the payments on the debt are simply postponed for a year. But then after that year, the payments are due again. But after a series of seven year sabbaticals, 49 years, and the following year, the Jubilee year, the 50th year, indeed debts are to be completely canceled, not simply the payments postponed. The logic behind that reasoning is that one of the laws of the sabbatical year, the 7-year cycle, is that the ground is to be worked for 6 consecutive years, and then in the 7th year, it's to lie fallow in order for it to rest and rejuvenate. Since Israel would, especially when they first entered Canaan, be primarily a farming society, it follows that a peasant Hebrew who owed money couldn't possibly pay it back during the year that he was forbidden by law to even grow a crop. How do you do that? It would be like making a law in the USA that every worker was to be given a furlough without pay for 1 year in every 7, but he still had to maintain all of his debt payments. A reasonably well-to-do person could plan for such a regular event by putting away 1/6 of each year's income so in the 7th year he had sufficient. But a low-income person who needs every penny to survive has no chance of saving up as much as to be needed. The poorest of the poor didn't own land, and they had to glean their food from the corners of fields belonging to others. Well, they were even in an even worse position. They had virtually nothing to start with. They had no means to store up grain and supplies or save money during the 6 years of divinely authorized field use so that they could draw from their storage, their savings account, if you would, during the 7th year when growing was prohibited. Yet even those desperately poor might borrow money from time to time to survive. Then as now, the poorest were the most sensitive to any kind of economic disruption. And please understand, a forced stoppage of growing crops for a full year every 50 years was pretty disruptive But a stoppage every seventh year? This was an enormous burden on the people of Israel. And therefore, there is no biblical record or record of any kind to demonstrate that Israel ever observed a Jubilee year according to God's laws. Can you envision a time in America where all fields were to be given a year's rest and all debts forgiven, and it was in the same year, coast to coast? Or that every kind of loan made to all people would be canceled all at once? The economic consequences would be catastrophic. Yet it is true that things weren't then in their economic system like it's with us today. One of the issues we need to understand is how and for what purpose the lending of money operated in those days. At first, particularly during the time of Moses until about the time of King David, lending money among the Hebrews was usually directed towards the poor and the needy. It was rarely a business proposition. Usually it was an act of kindness, albeit an act of kindness demanded by God. Loaning money, often in the form of food or seed grain, was designed to ensure that peasants and widows and orphans and the sick could survive. Only later did lending become a profitable business. When loaning money to the poor, generally the law was no interest could be charged among Israelites, so no profit could be made by the lender. Of course, in order to make a profit, charging instant interest was a given. So methods were eventually developed to do this, but it was never meant to apply to what had always previously been a matter of charity to the poor. So I want to put this in the form of a God principle. Lending money from a biblical perspective was not about a businessman making money or an investor investing in loans. Instead, it was about the more well-to-do in Hebrew society assisting those dependent people in Hebrew society, usually called brethren or kinsmen, who at times had no other way to get by a rough period without someone lending them some money. Lending was the cornerstone of the Israelite welfare system. When we fast forward a few centuries in the Bible, we'll find that indeed lending eventually did become a business. But generally speaking, it was not Hebrews who were the bankers, at least not at first. Rather, it was Hebrews who were the borrowers from the foreign lenders. Lenders for profit were generally looked down upon by the Hebrews as dishonest thieves. Therefore, it was the rare Hebrew who would become a banker, no matter how lucrative it could have been, because he would also have become a pariah in his own society. It's generally remained that way within Israel until the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar in the 6th century BC. In Babylon, Jewish culture changed dramatically. And one result was, upon their release and return to the Holy Land 70 years later, many of the professions that had been looked down upon in prior times, including being money lenders, was now taken up by Jews. And in time, those professions became common mainstays of the new Jewish society. Therefore, by the New Testament times, it was usual for Hebrews to be bankers. So we'll get stories about borrowing and lending as a money-making venture all during Christ's era. Now just understand that the purpose of borrowing and lending in the Torah became perverted by the time of Yeshua. And as you can imagine, the poor got the short end of the stick. After all, if you were a lender seeking to make a profit, who would you rather loan money to? A business person where you could make interest, or lend it at little, no interest to a needy person who had very little ability to pay it back? What would you do? It's not very hard to guess which route those with money chose to go when they were lending. Now notice what the flavor of money lending is in the world today. It's all about the wealthy controlling the money supply. It's all about the rich getting richer by means of consumers having the need to buy goods produced by those same wealthy businessmen. Here in America, we're getting money by means of home equity loans and car loans and personal loans and the use of credit cards. At one time was rather easy for the middle class. It certainly was not so easy for the poorest among us. The system and purpose that the Lord laid down for loaning and borrowing has been virtually turned on its head over the centuries. Those who need money the most can't get it. And those who use the loans for making more money or buying things that are far more wants than needs have it easily available. And they usually pay the least amount of interest. Now, since I believe that understanding the ancient cultures is central to properly understanding the words and intent of the Bible, let me add that borrowing and lending was, of course, a common thing since time immemorial. We have cuneiform tablets dating to before Abraham that lay out laws from various kings concerning borrowing and lending and release. Most of the ancient Assyrian clay tablets that have been discovered by the scores of thousands are accounting records and they're business transactions. Most of them are. So as we've been learning, most of the things God was ordaining as law for Israel, including the matter of social justice and release, these things concerned normal everyday matters. There were also long established norms among the world's nations. Among the Mesopotamian cultures, it was common for kings to release some of their subjects from debt or from slavery, from their prison sentences as part of their personal coronation celebration. Of course, while it made the king look magnanimous, the cost of it was on the shoulders of those who had paid substantial sums of money for slaves, or they lent money to others. It cost the king nothing. Later, we'll find the Greeks and the Athenians release serfs from their land debt, even take the land from the rich and powerful who took it from them and return it to those it rightfully belonged as a means of righting decades of social wrongs. Now, it's interesting to note that these laws of Moses concerning release and debt repayment and cancellation and so on only included Israelites. Foreigners had no obligations and they received no benefits from these laws. This is made all the more clear in verse 3 because it separates the treatment of foreigners from the kinsmen, kinsmen meaning a member of Israeli society. In verse 4, we reach the crux of the matter. It is the Lord's ideal that there be no poor in Israel. The concept is that the Lord is giving Israel land for which they didn't pay, vines they didn't plant, fields they didn't clear, even cities they didn't build. Therefore, there is no reason at all for anyone to go without. Everyone should be provided for. By the way, this does not include the lazy, the foolish, the criminal, or the rebellious. And that's going to be specifically called out a little bit later. And if only the Hebrews will obey God's laws about caring for the poor and releasing folks from debt and servitude as the Lord's command, then in return he'll bless Israel so abundantly that money and food won't even be an issue, ever. In fact, as it says in the following verses, the result will be that the Israelites won't be borrowing money from foreigners. Foreigners will be seeking to borrow money from the Israelites. Now notice the final words of verse 6. You, Israel, will dominate the nations. They will not dominate you. This is completely connected with the few words preceding it, which talks about lending money. The idea is that whatever person or society who lends money to another has a measure of domination over the borrower. I want to tell you a dirty little secret. The reason that America is so hated in many areas around the world is not so much because of our spiritual beliefs, as many might like to think. It's because we lend so much money to poverty-stricken third world nations, and then we demand repayment. They know this makes us dominant over them, even if we don't make any overt attempts at domination. They know that if we would show them mercy and release them from their debt to us, it would free them. It would lift an impossible burden off of their backs and hardly put a dent in our economy. Debt is enslaving. Believe it. Debt is enslaving. Debt creates social economic classes. Debt creates anxiety, bitterness. Debt controls the debtor. This principle of the lender being dominant over the borrower is at the heart of so many proverbs. So many New Testament commandments for the one who trusts the Lord to avoid borrowing, except perhaps for sheer survival. The New Testament cautions us that debt is equivalent to slavery to the one who borrows the money. It does not make borrowing or lending a sin per se. It's more a matter of wisdom versus foolishness. I want to expound a bit more on verse 4. There shall be no needy among you. This is one of those classic if-then dynamics that's at the center of the Mosaic Covenant. If Israel will do thus and so, then God will bless them in some way. One of the areas I think most neglected within Yeshua's church and perhaps the synagogue is an understanding of just what the Bible means, what it speaks of blessings and curses of the law. Evangelical Christians especially like to point to Paul's letters as he uses the phrase the curse of the law on a few occasions and say that it means, well, the law is bad. This is really pretty easy to explain, so I want to address it right here and now. Every law of God has two sides to it. A curse if it's disobeyed, a blessing if it's obeyed. It's that simple. The curse involves several elements. First, the curse is the result of sin, since being disobedient to God's laws is the definition of sin. The ultimate spiritual curse of law-breaking of sin is eternal death. The intermediate earthly and physical result of sin ranges from a minor penalty all the way up to being executed. The curse of the law is not the law itself. The law is not being called a curse that must be ended. The curse is the divine consequences of breaking the law, while the blessing is the reward that comes from God's hand for being obedient to his laws and commandments. What disciples of Yeshua, disciples of Christ, are saved from is the eternal spiritual consequence, the spiritual curse of breaking the law. And that consequence is eternal separation from God. We're not saved from divine or civil discipline here on earth. Nor are we saved from the requirement to be obedient to God's commandments. What we have just read here in the first few verses of Deuteronomy 15 makes it crystal clear case of how the law works. Obey it and receive blessings. disobey it, receive the curses, meaning the consequences. If Israel acts out that part of God's justice system that's designed to alleviate the suffering of the poorest of society, that part called release, Shemitah, then Israel's going to be greatly blessed. If they do not, the earthly physical penalty will be that they will find themselves fighting for their lives, for their existence, and they will be dominated by other nations in every imaginable way. Now, has that happened? Afraid so. And this disobedience automatically results in the stated consequence. The curse coming into effect. They were under constant attack from their enemies. They were finally driven into exile. They had to borrow money and so were indebted to foreigners. And even now, with their return to the land, they are holding on by their fingernails and wondering why. And this is to be understood as being a divinely ordained consequence. Now, verse 9 takes on the thought that would be the most likely to enter the mind of a person who had the wherewithal to be a lender to the poor under the rules Jehovah had just laid out. Since every seventh year, part of the debt that had not been repaid had to be canceled, and since a Hebrew bond servant who had enslaved himself to a master in order to repay a debt to that master or simply to have food and a roof over his head was to be released, set free from his bondage, as each seven-year cycle got nearer to its end, the lender stood to lose more money. See, this seven-year Hebrew cycle was set in the Hebrew calendar. It's not like buying a car with a seven-year loan that begins on the day you drive off the car lot, and then 7 years later, it ends. Instead, each seven-year cycle was simply a repeating cycle of the Jewish calendar. It wasn't tailored to each borrower or indentured servant. So, if a person borrowed money 5 years before the next release date came, the lender collected money from that person for 5 years before the remaining debt had to be canceled. But if that same borrowed money 3 years before the year of release came, the lender would only collect payment for 3 years and have to forgive the rest. What happened if 1 year before the year of release came and a person came to you seeking to borrow money, but you knew this person would have to pay it all back in 1 year, or you'd lose the remainder. And there was no way a typical peasant could pay back a sum of money in 1 year. Well, the thought would be that at some point before that year of release came, whether it's the 7 year cycle or the 50 year cycle, that lenders would simply stop loaning money because they didn't want to risk losing most of that money because the date of required debt cancellation was just around the corner. Well, to this, the Lord says that if that happens, that poor person whom the Lord cares so much about is going to cry out to him. And the person who refused to lend that money will incur guilt. And further, the Lord says, get used to it. This is how it's always going to be because there will never cease to be needy ones in the land. Here's the thing. We've talked a lot about how the Torah and the law are but God's heavenly ideals put into writing. These laws represent God's ideal justice system. I underline the word ideal because even though this is how God intends for things to be, and one day after Christ returns, it will be that way. Mankind's fall and our current corrupted state makes the actual carrying out of these ideals to their fullest extent a practical impossibility. sin is just too rampant within humanity for it to be any other way. This is reflected in the comment that despite Jehovah's intention that there is to be no poor in Israel, that's in verse 4, in earthly reality, he says in verse 11, there will always be poor among them that will need mercy and help. Naturally, it is this same concept that Jesus simply requotes in the New Testament when he tells his audience in John 12:8, for the poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. In verse 16, the situation is covered whereby an indentured servant, now remember these are Hebrew servants that are in service to other Hebrews, that this servant would prefer not to be released at the end of the sabbatical cycle or the Jubilee cycle, but to remain in service to his master. The servant is loved, he's happy, he wants to remain with this family. This servant does not have to be released. He can stay if it is at his own choosing. But if he stays, he's to have a special mark put on him, indicating that his status is no longer one of being a forced servant. Instead, he is one who has chosen to be in service to his master. Now, I hope the subtle difference kind of impacts you. There is an enormous difference between living in forced servitude versus committing to offer your service voluntarily. The first is the condition that we are told we have in relation to Satan before we're saved. The second is the condition the scriptures tell us we have in relation to God after we're saved. This mark of having freely chosen to be in service to a master is a pierced ear. Now, why that? Because the ear is the ancient symbol for obedience. The ear is the word picture of listening and being obedient to the voice of your master. Recall, as we've discussed before, the Bible says hearken or listen in English when it's translating the Hebrew word Shema. Shema does not mean a kind of passive listening like enjoying the chirp of a bird or the rhythmic splash of a waterfall. It means to pay attention to what your master is saying and to obey it. The topics of chapter 15 now take a right turn, because beginning in verse 19, it deals with the required and expected sacrifice of the newborn cattle, or rather the firstborn cattle. This falls in line with the regularly repeated demand that all firstlings belongs to the Lord. Firstlings include everything from farm animals to field crops to the tree harvest to sons born to a man. Only after these firstlings are offered to the Lord, thereby acknowledging him as the source and owner of all life, may the worshiper now partake. This was only a more detailed ordinance of the one that existed going back to the time of Adam and Eve. Because in Genesis 4, we find the story of Cain and Abel bringing offerings to the Lord, with Abel bringing the firstlings of his flock. The basics are that once per year, the firstlings are to be brought to the central sanctuary, first the wilderness tabernacle, later on the temple, where they're to be made a sacrifice by the priests. There and only there may the worshiper eat some of the meat of that particular sacrifice. In other words, a worshiper can't claim to sacrifice an animal to God in his hometown and then eat it. Sacrifice is only available at the place the Lord chooses. This opportunity to sacrifice before the Lord was given three times per year, as there were three pilgrimage festivals already ordained. Next, the sacrifice had to be without physical defect or blemish. This does not indicate the animal had to be 100% perfect. Rather, one couldn't offer an animal of lesser value. It was the best animal that the worshiper possessed. It was the most valuable animal that they owned that had to be offered. Further, in honor of the missive that the Lord had recently granted, allowing Israel to slaughter meat anytime they wanted to for food now, if a firstling was blemished and could not therefore be offered to God, then it was allowable to use it as a food animal. You know, people are people no matter what era. The ancients were the same as you and me. They were always on the lookout for a good loophole. We say, well, I know God says thus and so, but does he really mean what he says? Really, really, really? How about if we, and then we set forth a case of some extraordinary and unlikely circumstance full of twists and turns and unique conditions, figuring we can maybe qualify for a free pass on a technicality. This is why, after some new law is ordained or an existing law is clarified and expounded upon, the Lord will throw in a reminder of his principles, because his principles never change. Therefore, in verse 22, Yehovah reminds Israel that the laws of firstlings and the laws of secular slaughter for food that he's just discussed did not negate other aspects of the law, those laws, just because he didn't repeat them. If they hadn't been defective, are they're okay to be used as regular food? And the ritually unclean among you are eligible to eat these disqualified animals, just as there are the ritually clean people among you. But also remember that in every circumstance, the blood from an animal used for food, even if it's from a disqualified firstling, had to be disposed of by means of pouring it out on the ground. I'll close with this thought. I've often heard it said that if Jesus didn't specifically repeat an Old Testament commandment, then we don't have any obligation to it. I don't know where this idea came from. I just see it as very wishful thinking. No such principle exists in the Bible. In fact, Yeshua being God, knowing how we sons and daughters of man think, stops right in the middle of his Sermon on the Mount where he was expounding on the law, just like Moses was doing in his Sermon on the Mount, in Deuteronomy, and says, don't think I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've come to fulfill them. No, not one jot, not one stroke's going to pass from the law until heaven and earth passes away. Pretty clear. Next week, we're going to take up the matter of the pilgrimage festivals that we read about again in Deuteronomy chapter 16.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.